All right, so we're all muted. Just a few reminders. You can
first, right?
What's that?
The song first, and then welcome.
No. Speaker view versus gallery view. You can set up to view everyone or just who's speaking in Zoom, and that's it. And here's the opening song. Thanks to Amber. That was Chardez from Capella by Delabies. Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is John Wunderlin and my pronouns are he, him, and his. I've been a member of Prairie for 6 years and I'm a member of the board as well as the building committee and housing and property committees. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. During our virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. We will also have joys and concerns during that time. We have a few announcements. We are sharing our offering this quarter with the Street Pulse. Street Pulse is the organization and name of the newspaper that provides income to Madison's homeless through direct newspaper sales. You can go to Prairie's website and click on Give to make an offering. The UUA General Assembly is totally virtual this year. Check the order of service for the website link. Virtual Dungeons and Dragons, the beginners group, meets every Monday at 4:30. The link is in the order of service and emailed out to Prairie News. Wednesday, Fun with Holly this week at 6:30 p.m. All are welcome to join by Zoom. And again, the link is in the order of service and emailed out in Prairie News. Virtual Dungeons and Dragons, the advanced group, meets every Friday at 4:30. Link is in the order of service and emailed to Prairie News. Nancy will read our chalice lighting. Feel free to light your own candle or chalice during this time.
This is called Hymn to the Light by David Breeden. Our light is the light of the sun, keeper of all we love. Our light is the light of the earth, provider of sustenance. Our light is the light of all living things, all precious like our own. Our light is the light of each of us, bound together in need and hope. Our light is the light of the cosmos, keeper of all we know.
We will now have a silent meditation. And now we're going to have the story for all ages. The book is called I Am Human.
Susan Verity. By Susan Verity.
John, the video mute is on, just so you know. You have to unmute the video.
Counselor Copeland. Today's book is I Am Human, A Book of Empathy by Susan Verity, art by Peter H. Reynolds. I am human. I was born a miracle, one of billions, but unique. I am human. I am always learning. I'm finding my way and choosing my path on this incredible journey. I have big dreams. I see possibility. I have endless curiosity. I make discoveries. I have a feeling of wonder. I am amazed by nature. I have a playful side. I find joy in friendships. I am human. But being human means I am not perfect. I make mistakes. I can hurt others with my words, my actions, and even my silence. I can be hurt too. I can be fearful of things I don't yet understand and timid to try something new. I have a heavy heart when I feel sadness. I am human. But then I remind myself that because I am human, I can make choices. I can move forward. A poor choice can become a better choice with thoughtfulness. A bad day can become a great day with kindness. I can act with compassion and lend a helping hand. I can treat others with equality and be fair. I can choose not to fight, but instead to listen and find common ground. I can say, I'm sorry, and ask for forgiveness. I am not alone. I am connected to my friends, to my family, to the world. We are all humans together. And I will keep trying to be the best version of me. I am full of hope. I am human. The end. Thank you so much for listening to another one of my favorite mindfulness books. Remember, being human isn't always easy, but it's what makes us beautiful and unique. We are in this together.
Okay. I'd like to introduce our presenter today. Robert Steifer is a professor at UW-Madison with appointments in medical history and bioethics and in philosophy. His research explores ethical issues arising from the use of modern biotechnology. He has presented to the National Academy's Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research Advisory Committee and to the German Ethics Council on the ethics of creating part human, part animal chimeras for research purposes. Today's presentation is Ethics, CRISPR, and Human Genome Editing, and relates to the second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Robert, go ahead.
Good morning. Let me get my screen going. Is that working?
Yep.
Can people hear me okay?
Yes.
So this is Dr. He Jiankui. He's a researcher in China. And in November of 2018, he made an announcement that startled the scientific community, the medical community, the research community. But for him, it was a moment of proud accomplishment. So he announced the successful birth of twin girls whose genomes he had edited using a technology called CRISPR. He did not receive the reaction that he perhaps would have liked. His research was suspended. He was condemned by scientists and ethicists and medical communities around the world. He was disavowed by the university that he was employed at and the hospital that was involved with the research. He was fired from his university position, and he's now been sentenced to 3 years in jail and fined about $430,000. So it went from a proud announcement to the wrecking of his entire career. I'm going to talk about the ethics of the technology that Dr. He used and come back at the end to sort of how to think about what he did in particular and whether or not the criticisms that have been made of his work apply quite generally to this technology or are instead sort of specific to the way that he tried to implement it. I'm going to start off with a little bit of background on this technology. So the most commonly used form of this technology is sometimes referred to as CRISPR-Cas9. CRISPR is an acronym. It stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. And that's sort of one part of the technology. And then the Cas9 part is a slightly different part. So, and Cas here stands for CRISPR-associated protein, of which Cas9 is one of many examples that could be used, but it is the most common one. And this is a technology that in some ways is found in nature. So it's modeled on some discoveries of how the immune systems of bacteria worked. And this was a discovery made back in the 1980s. And it appears to provide bacteria with an adaptive immune system to defend itself against viruses. And what we have learned how to do is to use this technology to actually modify DNA. So just a quick kind of explanation of how this works. So CRISPR-Cas9 consists of sort of two separable parts, conceptually speaking. The CRISPR-associated protein, in this case Cas9, is, let's see, can I get a hand to show? Can you see my mouse moving on the screen? Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry for the interruption. So the Cas9 part is what's called an endonuclease that can sever strands of DNA. So it basically cuts the chemical bonds in DNA. And so it can split a string of DNA into two parts. And then there's a guide RNA that basically tells the Cas9 endonuclease where to make that cut. And you put these two together and you have what has been described by some people as kind of a guided missile. You can direct it to any point of the genome that you're looking at or the DNA sequence that you're looking at. You can target it with this guide RNA, and then it will use the Cas9 endonuclease to make a cut at that point in the RNA. And this allows us to make targeted changes to strands of DNA, including DNA in human cells, including human embryos. And so here's sort of a useful metaphor. This is from Kiran Masanura at the University of Pennsylvania that I find sort of helpful. If you think of a very long strand of DNA as an instruction manual, the guide RNA part of CRISPR-Cas9 targets a point in that instruction manual between two lines of instructions. Okay, so imagine you're flipping through a book and on page 12, right, you could target this at between line 3 and line 4 on that page. And that's using the guide RNA. And then what the endonuclease does is it basically makes a tear at that point in the instruction manual. So imagine that you're tearing the page right between line 3 and line 4. But sometimes when you make a tear between two lines, you end up rendering those two lines unreadable, right? Because the tear sort of can't be seen. if you do that in the genetic context, you've actually succeeded in knocking out a gene. So you've rendered an instruction non-functional. So you can knock out genes using this technology. Cells also have mechanisms by which they try to repair those breaks in DNA. And this is just part of the natural way that cells work and try to maintain themselves. Well, we know that if you feed a cell lots of copies of DNA that matches the two ends, the start and the end of the cut, that the cell mechanisms can take that DNA and paste it back into the manual. And it's using the DNA just on the ends to make that match. Well, we can take out the DNA in the middle and put in whatever DNA we want. And now the CRISPR-Cas9 will insert that gene into the genome of the cell. So a combination of CRISPR-Cas9 making these openings in DNA and then the natural mechanisms of cells trying to fix those by putting in repair DNA, and we can tinker with what DNA it uses to make the repair, we can actually get this to insert genes into DNA. Okay, so this technology lets us knock out genes and also insert genes and make a wide array of other kinds of genomic modifications. Now, we've been able to do this kind of thing for a long time. So in the 1970s, we had genetic engineering, which was developed. And it's a similar technology that allows us to knock out genes and also insert genes. What's different about CRISPR is that it's so much more efficient and so much more accurate than the old school genetic engineering that people actually have introduced a new name. So now it's called gene editing if you're using CRISPR. And the old school stuff is called genetic engineering. And it has fewer unintended effects than the old school way of doing genetic engineering. And you can use it to modify the genome at several points at once in one time and one intervention. Whereas using old school genetic engineering, that was very, very difficult to do. If you made two genetic changes, you were doing really well, and three was worthy of a publication in Science or Nature. Now, doing multiple edits at once is actually quite easy. The National Academy of Sciences summed it up this way. So this is from a 2017 report. They said, when conducted carefully and with proper oversight, gene therapy research, have been developed using old school genetic engineering, has enjoyed support from many stakeholder groups. But because such technologies as CRISPR-Cas9 have made genome editing so efficient and precise, they have opened up possible applications that have until now been viewed as largely theoretical. So sort of in principle, we can't really do anything now that we couldn't do before. But our ability to do it has been significantly enhanced. And alterations that in the past would have taken thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to do and months of work in a lab can now be done for mere hundreds of dollars and can be done literally in a few hours. So the rapidity and the economic costs of doing this have improved dramatically over what we used to be able to do. And a lot of labs that used to work with genetic engineering technology are rapidly moving to use CRISPR because it's so much faster, it's so much more accurate, and it's so much cheaper. So I want to think about the ethics of applying this technology to humans. There are lots of ethical issues thinking about applying this to crops and non-human animals, but our focus is going to be on humans. And I want to draw a pretty large circle to begin with, and then I'll draw some distinctions within that circle to try to organize the discussion. So let's think of interventions, the term interventions, as a very broad umbrella term covering any kind of medical intervention. So it could be just a regular old surgery or a vaccination or a cast for a bone or whatever. Okay, so a very broad category of interventions. Well, in the context of editing the genomes of human beings, there have been two distinctions that have played a very large role in thinking about the ethics and also politics of using something like CRISPR-Cas9. So one distinction is the distinction between using CRISPR to edit somatic cells. So somatic cells are the non-reproductive cells in the human body. So not sperm, not eggs, not embryos, not the cells that become sperm. So we're talking about things like skin cells or cheek cells or retinal cells. Okay, so those are somatic cells. And then the other kind of editing that is contrasted with is the editing of what are called germline cells. And so these are the reproductive cells. So the sperm, egg, embryos, or the sperm progenitors is something that researchers work on. These are the cells that will turn into sperm. And so this is a distinction between what's called somatic cell therapies or interventions and germline interventions. And the difference, of course, is that with germline interventions, because you're changing a reproductive cell, if the individual that is the product of that reproductive cell goes on to reproduce, those cells are going to be inherited, those changes are going to be inherited by their offspring as well. So that's one important difference. Whereas if I make an edit to an adult skin cell, for example, and then they reproduce, well, that edit isn't going to be passed on to their offspring because all I did was mess with a skin cell. I didn't mess with their sperm or eggs. And the other big difference is that if we make the change at the very beginning with a reproductive cell, that change is going to be inherited by all the cells of that individual, at least if we do the change properly. Whereas if I go in and edit a skin cell, well, that's the only cell that I've edited. Okay. So that's the distinction between somatic cell interventions and germline interventions. And then the second distinction that has been discussed widely in this context is a distinction between treatment on the one hand, right? So somebody has a disease and you can treat them for that disease, hopefully cure it or at least ameliorate it, and enhancement. And people give lots of examples of enhancement of, you know, somebody who's already of normal height, but they'd like to be a little bit taller so they could be better at basketball. So you're enhancing their height, but you're not treating any disease or disorder. You're enhancing them. And I'll give some more examples of this later. But so with these two distinctions, we can draw a grid that would allow us to think about interventions, this broad class of things that involve human genome editing with CRISPR, and we can divide it into four cells. We can ask, are somatic cell treatments ever permissible? And if so, under what circumstances? What about somatic cell enhancements? And then what about germline treatment? And what about germline enhancement? Okay. And my first argument here using this these distinctions is going to be that at least some somatic cell treatments are permissible. And in fact, they're permissible for the same reason that ordinary run-of-the-mill medical care is permissible and under the same circumstances. Right, so that's going to be my sort of first argument here. So let me introduce a second term. We've got interventions as this broad term, got a distinction between germline and somatic cell interventions, and a distinction between enhancements and treatments. Let's call an intervention responsible if it meets the kind of run-of-mill ethics standards that we require for normal medical care, right? So getting a shot or a blood draw or surgery or something like that. Well, as a general rule, routine medical interventions are ethical just in case they meet two basic ethical standards. One, they should be done with informed consent. And two, they should have an acceptable risk-benefit ratio for the patient. So they don't have to be risk-free. Lots of surgeries, of course, have significant risks, but they have to have an acceptable risk-benefit ratio. Okay? And let's say that an intervention is responsible just in case it meets those two run-of-the-mill ethical standards. Okay? So my first argument is going to be that somatic cell treatments are ethically permissible when they're responsible, when they meet these two standards. And sometimes they do meet those standards, and therefore some somatic cell treatments are ethical. And I want to try to motivate that argument by thinking about a case. So this is a picture of Victoria Gray, last year in 2019. She was one of the very first people to be treated with a CRISPR-based intervention. So she has sickle cell disease. This is a genetic condition that affects hemoglobin, which is in your red blood cells. And the red blood cells that have the affected hemoglobin don't function very well. They clump together and form blockages in blood vessels. They reduce the lifespan. The modified hemoglobin reduces the lifespan of the red blood cells, and it makes it so that the cells can't move cleanly through blood vessels. So the results include severe pain, blood vessel blockages, and a shortage of red blood cells. So you can get anemia from this. And patients have to get transfusions to deal with this. So using CRISPR, we have what is now a treatment for this. So it's at the very early stages, but it looks like it's very promising. So doctors take cells from a patient such as Victoria Gray. They take them out of the patient's body. They use CRISPR to modify those cells to make a better form of the hemoglobin protein. So instead of making the defective protein, they make one that it's not perfect, but it's not as defective. It works better. And then we irradiate the patient's own bone marrow, which normally generates red blood cells with this genetic problem. So we get rid of all those from the patient using irradiation. And then we transplant the modified red blood cells that we've taken out of the patient back into them. So they now have CRISPR-edited blood cells, very roughly. So basically it's a bone marrow transplant that we're talking about here. And because the cells that we're introducing have been modified with CRISPR to make this better form of hemoglobin, when the bone marrow makes red blood cells, it actually makes red blood cells that aren't as affected by the bad form of hemoglobin. So they function better. And in fact, the preliminary data that's been released since this trial was announced actually looked quite promising. So she reports substantial reductions in the amount of pain she experiences. She's reporting substantial reduction in the number of blood transfusions she needs. So again, very early, very sort of one of four trials that are taking place right now to sort of try to figure this out. But it looks like a very promising technique that could have lots of benefits for people who have some pretty bad genetic conditions. So thinking about that kind of example, I think, well, that's just medical care. And that's ethical if it's done with informed consent and if it has an acceptable risk-benefit ratio, which it looks like it does. Right? It's very risky procedures, but it looks like in the end it is going to be beneficial for her. So I submit that for somatic cell treatments, which this sickle cell treatment is an example of, that those are ethical if they're responsible, if they meet those two conditions of informed consent and acceptable risk-benefit ratio. They are sometimes responsible. They do sometimes meet those two conditions, and therefore they're sometimes ethical. And so I give that a green color sort of indicate that I think, you know, this is ethical, not always, of course, right? There's still ethical standards that medical care has to meet. But insofar as this meets them and it can, then it's ethical. No different from other kinds of medical interventions. Okay. Now, some people want to say that somatic cell treatments can be ethical, but they want to say, but we draw the line at germline. We're not going to allow any germline treatments at all. Okay, so they want to put a sort of, you know, maybe it's never permissible, or at least sort of it's not going to be permissible in the near future or in any world that's sort of remotely like ours. So maybe we can imagine some perfect utopia where it could be done, but never here. So they want to put something red in this bottom left box for germline treatments. Okay. Well, if you agree with me that we should be putting something, a green square in the upper left quadrant, and you want to say, but I draw the line at germline, what's the argument going to be for that, right? Why think that somatic cell treatment is okay, but germline treatments are not? Well, the most common example, well, sorry, two different ways we could go here. So it could be that the standards for somatic cell treatment and germline treatment are the same, but it might be impossible, or at least nearly impossible, right? Impossible for all practical purposes for germline treatment to ever meet those standards. Okay, so same two standards, informed consent, acceptable risk-benefit ratio. But while we can meet that in the case of somatic cell treatments, we can't meet that in the case of germline treatments. And I'll look at an example of this kind of argument in just a second. Or it could be that you think that there are actually different standards that apply to germline treatment. And in fact, they're not just different, they're in fact much stricter than we would have for other medical interventions, including somatic cell treatment. And so germline treatment could be ethical if it meets those much stricter standards, but in point of fact, it's impossible or nearly impossible for germline treatment to ever meet those standards. So not in the near future is germline treatment ever going to be ethical. Okay, so we can have sort of two different arguments, same standards, but impossible to meet, or different standards that are impossible to meet. Okay? So let's talk about this idea that maybe the standards are the same, but when it comes to germline engineering, it's impossible to meet them. And the key argument here that's been made by a lot of people is that with germline treatment, because you're modifying an embryo, you cannot get informed consent from the individual that you're modifying, right? If you go to the doctor, we can get informed consent from you before we do some medical intervention. But for an embryo, right, they cannot give consent. So, and in the absence of consent, right, according to the normal standards, you're not supposed to proceed with the medical intervention. So this is a very common argument for putting a red color in the bottom left quadrant. It's ethical only with informed consent. That's part of the normal standards. Informed consent can never be obtained for a germline intervention because the individual that you're modifying is either not yet in existence if you're modifying a sperm or an egg, or it's just an embryo, in which case you can't get its consent. And so never ethical. Okay, so this is one of the arguments that you hear for saying somatic cell can be permissible because you can get consent. Germline, you can't get consent, and so not permissible. Now, the problem with this is that, in fact, we don't always require informed consent for all medical interventions. So we require informed consent when we have a competent adult who can consent, right? At least has the capacity to consent. But when it comes to young children, we don't get their informed consent in a morally meaningful way. They can't consent because they aren't autonomous yet. For babies, right? We don't have informed consent. And yet we think it's permissible to do medical interventions on them if the risk-benefit ratio is acceptable. And in those cases, we do have a surrogate for informed consent from the individual who's affected. It's consent from the parents or the guardians. And we can get consent from the parents or guardians for germline treatment, right? So we're not going to do it on somebody's embryo where they haven't consented to it, but we will if they consent. And if the risk-benefit ratio is acceptable, then this looks like the same kind of thing that we might do for a young child or a baby, or an adult who might have lost capacity because of some mental illness or developmental disability, right? So this idea that medical interventions are ethical only with informed consent is actually oversimple, right? We require informed consent when the patient has the capacity for consent. But if they don't, we just look for consent from the guardian. And that is something that we can get in the case of germline treatment. So that suggests, right, that in fact, if you agree with the standards and you can get consent, and while it's probably true right now that the risk-benefit ratio isn't acceptable because we've never done this yet in humans and we have limited experience with it, even in animals, and there's a lot to learn about it, it probably will reach an acceptable risk-benefit ratio in the not-too-distant future. And I don't know how to put a precise prediction on that, if it's 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, I don't know. But it seems like, as with every other medical technology, researchers and doctors are going to continue improving it, making it safer, making it better. And so it doesn't seem like there's any in principle objection to the idea that germline engineering could be done ethically once it meets that safety threshold. OK, Okay. So that's an argument then, not for green in this box, because I don't think we've got an acceptable risk-benefit ratio at the present time, whereas for some somatic cell treatments, I think we do, but probably in the near future, we are going to be able to say, you know, this is no less safe than lots of other things that we think are justified. Okay. So that's an argument for a yellow in that lower right quadrant. Okay. That's assuming that the standards are the same. What about the idea that, in fact, the standards should be much stricter for germline engineering? And so it's not enough to have informed consent. It's not enough to have an acceptable risk-benefit ratio. In fact, there's sort of new standards that are justified here. And once you take into account those new standards that are going to be much harder to justify, in fact, you'll see that germline treatments are not going to be permissible. So this would be another kind of argument for a prohibitory stance with respect to germline treatments. Ethical only if these much stricter standards can be met, but they can't be met, at least not in the not too distant future. And so this isn't going to be ethical in the not too distant future. And some examples of groups that have made this kind of argument. So this is from the Center for Genetics and Society, one of the professional organizations here. And in response to Dr. Hu's announcement, they posted a press statement, claim of genetically modified babies, if true, a grave abuse of human rights. They say this amounts to unethical, reckless experimentation, strongly condemn this stunt. Throwing open the door to a society of genetic haves and have-nots undermines our chances for a fair and just society. So they're worried, if you read the literature behind the press statement, they're worried about Dr. Hu's conflicts of interest. So he has a financial stake in a company that makes these kinds of CRISPR therapeutics. And so they're worried about that. He has some patents on CRISPR-related technologies. So he has some pretty significant financial conflicts of interest. And they're worried, as they say down here with the haves and have-nots, that these kinds of treatments are going to be incredibly expensive. So could be upwards of millions of dollars to do these things. And so it's going to be a treatment that's accessible to the very wealthy, but not to the very poor, at least in countries that don't have universalized healthcare like the United States doesn't have. So these kinds of issues, right? Financial conflicts of interest, expensive technologies, providing even more of an edge for people who are already very well off as compared to people who are relatively disadvantaged. These are going to be problems with this for a very long time. And so if we have to sort of solve those problems, then this technology is not going to be ethical for a long time. There was another report by some very prominent bioethicists and CRISPR researchers that argued for a moratorium on heritable genome editing, so germline editing. And they cited concerns about the fact that this is still very contentious and that religious groups have significant objections to this and they haven't sort of been brought on board. A lot of commentators here have argued that essentially germline engineering can be done permissibly only when we reach the point where we're certain that it's absolutely safe. Well, if these are the standards, right? Absolute safety, no risk at all, no social controversy about it, all the main religious groups on board. Well, these are not going to be resolved for a long time. And so if those are the standards, then this is not going to be ethical for a long time. So that's the kind of argument that you might get to fill in a red in this bottom left quadrant by appealing to these sort of stricter standards. Now, the problem is that those stricter standards are implausible. They're implausibly strict. We have financial conflicts of interest throughout the medical system, and they are certainly problematic. But we don't say just because somebody involved in the development of a technology had a financial conflict of interest that we're going to say it's unethical to actually cure somebody's disease with that treatment, right? We don't say that, and we shouldn't say that. This idea that a technology is going to be okay only if it's risk-free. Well, that's a standard that we don't impose for any other medical intervention at all. Every medical intervention has risks, right? The question is whether or not the risks are acceptable given the potential benefits. That's always the question. And then finally, the idea that we're going to hold a technology captive, especially a technology that involves reproduction, because we're talking about, right, modifying embryos here. We're going to hold that captive until we get all the major religions on board. I think that's not an acceptable way of doing public policy in a country that actually enforces a distinction between church and state, right? So we should have respectful discussion with religious groups. We should hear their concerns. And if those concerns are reasonable and provide a legitimate secular basis for restricting this technology, then those concerns should be heard and incorporated. But the mere idea that we have to sort of get permission from religious groups before we can use a technology, that's inappropriate conflation of church and state, right? We don't let the religious groups sort of hold public decisions captive, or at least we shouldn't, okay? So if these stricter standards were the correct standards, then it would be a long time before we had any germline treatments that were ethical, but I think they're all implausibly strict. So again, I think we're looking at yellow in that box down there once we adopt sort of reasonable standards, okay? What about treatment versus enhancement? So just a couple more slides. I know I think I'm going over a little bit on time. So what could make it the case that a somatic cell treatment, so we'll deal with the top row first, could be ethical, whereas a somatic cell enhancement could not be ethical? Okay, why might somebody think that's problematic? Well, that would be the case only if the goods or benefits that were promoted by a somatic cell treatment were always more important than the goods promoted by a somatic cell enhancement. Because if the goods were the same, and if the risks were the same, right, because they're both somatic cell, then it would seem like you should be able to go ahead in both cases. Well, sometimes you get examples that suggest this is what people think, that treatments are always more important than enhancements. So people will contrast treating someone's life-threatening illness versus enhancing someone's height, right? So I'm 5'6", I'd like to be 5'10", so I could be better at basketball. Well, that's not treating me for anything, that's enhancing me. That's trivial, that's not worth doing, but treating somebody's life-threatening illness, that's really important. People will say, well, look, you know, treatment might be for something like blindness, right? That would be really great if we could come up with a cure for blindness. Contrast that with enhancing somebody's already excellent vision beyond 20/20. So maybe an athlete or a jet fighter, right? They might want an enhancement even though their vision is fine. Well, the goods there are very different, right? Curing blindness, much more important than improving somebody's already good vision. Or treating muscular dystrophy versus enhancing the muscles of somebody who's already a world-class weightlifter, but they want to be even better. Right? So these are the kind of examples that people put forward, which suggest that they are thinking that treatments are always important and enhancements are never important. But those are a very narrow selection of examples. So consider treating somebody's premature baldness, right? Nothing wrong with that, but pretty trivial in the grand scheme of things, versus enhancing someone's immune system to prevent COVID-19, right? Imagine we get a vaccine that enhances somebody's immune system and we stop the pandemic, or enhancing their immune system so that they don't get AIDS or they don't get cancer, right? Here, enhancements are much more important than the treatments. And there are lots of examples of enhancements that we think are incredibly important and lots of examples of treatments that are quite trivial because the conditions that they're treatments for are quite trivial. And it doesn't just apply in the medical case. So education, right, is an enhancement. Exercise, a good diet, right? These all enhance our lives, enhance our health, enhance our well-being. They're all incredibly important. In fact, many times they're often more important than medical treatments, right? If you can fix a problem with those things, it's often actually better than trying to treat it with a drug or surgical intervention. So this idea that the treatment versus enhancement distinction sort of maps on to what's important and what's not is, I think, a mistake, okay? So I think we should get a green in this upper right square. And now the last step is pretty straightforward. If you think that, right, some enhancements can be responsible, and if you think that some germline treatments can be responsible, at least in the not too distant future, then you don't think that the treatment enhancement distinction is sort of a definitive distinction, morally speaking. And you don't think that the somatic cell germline distinction is a definitive distinction, morally speaking. So you should be willing to put yellow in that lower right box as well, right? It's the only thing that makes sense given everything that we've already said, okay? So now let's return to Dr. Hu. Just a few more slides here. So November 2018, Antonio Rigolato of the MIT Press Tech Review broke the news roughly simultaneously with a story from the Associated Press that Chinese scientists are creating CRISPR babies. And here's the headline from that. So Hu Jiankyu noticed that there appears to be an association between a particular deletion mutation in a particular gene called the CCR5 gene that confers resistance to some strains of HIV infection. And this wasn't noticed initially by him. This was in the literature already. So he said, oh, look, there appears to be this gene deletion that confers this medical benefit, right, resistance to HIV. And so he decided to use CRISPR to edit two embryos to delete the CCR5 gene. And then he implanted those embryos in the woman of the couple that donated the gametes from which the embryos were made, and they were brought to term. And in fall 2018, he announced that the two twins, which he gave the pseudonyms Lulo and Nana to, were born. And as I mentioned, he was sort of promptly disavowed by everybody, and he's now been fined and is in jail. Okay, so they did not react to this as a wonderful scientific and medical breakthrough. Well, why not? Was it because there's something in principle wrong with germline, in this case, enhancement, right? They didn't have a condition that he was treating them for. He was trying to enhance them. Well, there are actually lots of reasons why people objected to what he did that really have nothing to do with the fact that it was a germline enhancement. So first, Dr. Hu had no experience running a clinical trial at all. He was a physicist. He didn't have the appropriate medical background to be doing this kind of thing. It's not clear that he had approval from his human subjects committee. So it was alleged, I don't know, I can't verify this independently, but it was alleged that he basically forged documents in order to show that he had the proper approval. Clinical trials are kind of research that are supposed to be registered before they're started, so that no matter what the outcome is, whether it's a positive outcome or a negative outcome, people know that the trial took place. Well, it turned out that he only registered it long after the trial had essentially been done, after the twins had born. So he retroactively registered a trial in something that was supposed to be registered prospectively. Lots of concerns had been raised about the informed consent that he had. He didn't properly explain what he was doing to the parents involved. And this is a kicker. So this is from the English translation, based on the English translation of the consent form. If you were a participating couple in this research who had had a successful implantation of an embryo and no identified genetic defects of serious diseases in that embryo, so as far as you knew, the embryo was healthy, and you wanted to leave the study at that point, then the couple who wanted to leave the study would have to return all the costs of the IVF and the CRISPR to the project team, which had been covered as part of the research. But if you wanted to leave, you actually had to pay for it yourself. And that's about $40,000, which for this particular socioeconomic group is an awful lot of money. And as a kicker, it required patients to agree that if they were late in paying that $40,000, they could be fined an additional $14,000. We do not like that as part of the consent process for research or for medical care, right? We're going to actually make money off of late fees like banks do nowadays or credit card companies, right? That is not how this is supposed to be done. It was also premature. And this is sort of agreed on by everybody who's looked at this. So we don't really yet have the preclinical data to establish that this kind of treatment has an acceptable risk-benefit ratio. And even though the dad was HIV positive, the children had no active disease and they're not at any significant risk of being infected. There are lots of ways to prevent transmission from an HIV positive dad to embryos using IVF. It turned out that gene editing was actually ineffective in one child, so it didn't actually delete the gene. And in the other child, it deleted the gene in some of the cells, but not in others. So they didn't do it at the one cell stage. They did it after the embryo had divided, and several of the cells didn't take up the change. So it's not clear that that provides any health benefit. Moreover, even in the cells that were edited using CRISPR, it looks like he induced a mutation different from the one that's actually believed to confer resistance to some strains of HIV. So the particular knockout gene that's supposed to confer this resistance, he actually didn't knock out the right gene, basically. He didn't follow up with testing to see whether or not the cells were immune to HIV infection before he implanted them. And it's known, and was known at the time, that the CCR mutation actually makes one more susceptible to influenza, which in that particular geographic and socioeconomic region is actually more of a risk than HIV is. So it's not even clear that he made a good judgment there. And then just to add one final point, the final thing, he announced that there was a second pregnancy with a third child that should have come to term in August 2019. So there weren't just two, there were actually three. And that third child has now been confirmed to exist by Chinese officials. So there's actually three CRISPR edited, or at least babies upon whom CRISPR editing has been attempted in the world now. And so there's a lot for us to be thinking about. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks so much, Robert. So we're going to open up for some discussion and raise your hand either with the app or right in your screen, and I'll unmute you. So Renee, why don't you go ahead first?
So thank you for the presentation. We have a little bit of a personal connection. Obviously, nothing's been CRISPR edited, but my husband has a very rare genetic disease. It's a 50% dominance. So half of his family has it and he has it. So that meant each of our children would have a 50% chance of having it.
Right.
I did not know this. He did not know this until 2 weeks before our first was born. He received a text from his mom and I freaked out and I Googled it, of course. And it turns out that it's not life-threatening. It's a extra bone in your body.
Okay.
It resolves on its own by 3 years of age. There's no long-term negative consequences. Both of our children have it. It's called Caffey disease. And I was really obviously nervous, understandably, of having a genetic, very, very rare. None of the pediatricians, no one had heard of it ever. And I mean, it turned out fine. And if I had known what I know now, if this technology, although it's in its initial stages, had been around, I would not have done it.
Right.
Because when you're talking about the risk and benefits, it is one that they were in pain because they had extra bone in their body, which you're not supposed to have. So there was inflammation.
Okay.
How much pain? I don't know. We can't talk to infants, right? But by the age of 6 months, they were no longer crying as much. So it pretty much by 6 months was seeming to have mostly resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, our oldest one's 3.5. She's totally fine. There's no long-term consequences. So when you were talking about the risk and benefit ratio, now if I had an embryo with cystic fibrosis,
right,
or some genetic disease that has, basically death,
right,
as a assured outcome. And for that one, I looked up the average lifespan is like 30s. So can you imagine like having all this and you have a fully adult, right, who has this and dies in their 30s? Yep. I mean, I definitely think that would have been a different situation. You know what I mean? So it's definitely not like a black and white situation. And I do think there are a lot of gray in here. So that's a personal, I guess, connection I have with this kind of a thing. So thank you for the presentation.
That's a great example. And it illustrates, I think, the importance of thinking about this on a case-by-case basis, as opposed to lumping in, you know, into one big undifferentiated category, sort of all different kinds of germline treatments, because the benefits of those can be very different depending on what the condition is that you're trying to treat. So in your case, it sounds like there was, you know, significant discomfort, but it was time limited, long term, you know, not a problem. I can't imagine a responsible doctor sort of recommending, you know, an as yet untested germline technology to try to fix that. You just suffer with it and then it's gone eventually. But you're right, for something that has much more serious consequences, then that's going to affect that risk benefit ratio. My understanding, and I'm not a doctor, so I mean, I have a PhD, but I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a philosopher by training. But my understanding is that while I think you're right about the average age for people with cystic fibrosis, that includes a lot of people who weren't getting sort of current state of the art treatment from the start. And so now if you're born with cystic fibrosis, getting what we think is sort of the best treatment, we've actually improved lifespans. I think it's up in the 40s now. But still, of course, right, that's a lot of life to lose and a lot of difficulty before you even get to that point with something like cystic fibrosis. And so that's going to affect that risk-benefit ratio. And that's one of the reasons why I was so vague about what the not-too-distant future might look like, or what exactly that time frame is. Because if something is really, really important, then we might be willing to try something that was a little riskier rather than waiting until it was safer, because waiting has its costs too. And so there's no sort of one answer about when is it safe enough. It's going to depend on what the treatment is. Mm-hmm. That's a great example. I did have one question in a private chat. So who appoints and monitors the researchers and organizations that plan to do ethical treatment? So it depends on whether or not the treatment is taking place in the context of clinical care, right? Just somebody going to their doctor and getting medical care, as we all do, or if it's taking place in a research context where you're part of a study that might be treating you, but is also using you as a data point to learn about how to treat other people better and improve things for others down the road. So for medical care, it's basically the medical care infrastructure. So doctors have to be licensed, right? If they're working in hospitals, the hospitals have to get their licenses, and often they're accredited and they're overseen by medical boards and those kinds of things. The FDA oversees some of that. But strictly speaking, it's the states that regulate medical care. And so it's going to vary from state to state, sort of who's responsible for that and whether or not something is going to count as malpractice or negligence. Doctors do a lot of novel experimental treatment on people sort of all the time. They use their best judgment, their best clinical judgment, to do things that haven't been very well tested. That doesn't count as research, even though it's experimental in a sense, because you're using something that we don't know a lot about. But that's sort of covered under one set of regulations. In a research context, right, it's going to get overseen by what are called institutional review boards, which are required by federal law if you're using any federal money, which most research does. And even if you're not using federal money, most private organizations that do medical research agree to follow the federal regulations because it sets a sort of socially accepted baseline. So they also have human subjects committees that are going to review these things. So there's actually an additional level of review when you're doing something in research than when you're going and just getting something in the privacy of your own doctor's office, right? Nobody looks at that unless sort of something goes wrong. But in the research context, things have to be approved beforehand by this review board. Changes have to be reviewed. Adverse events have to be kept track of and reported. And the IRB can say, hey, you know, we think this is getting too risky. We want you to stop or whatever. And part of the issue with Dr. He was that it was a research trial, but he didn't really have the infrastructure and the connections and the background and the training to pull that off. This is something that researchers train for decades and work in places like UW-Madison, just to toot our own horn here, right? We do a huge amount of medical research, but we have hundreds of people who are trained, you know, staff members, doctors, and others who are trained in overseeing that and who sort of keep a close eye on how things are going. Not that we don't have our scandals every now and then, but it's pretty well regulated. Right now, the FDA in the US has said that they're going to treat CRISPR for medical care, like trying to treat cystic fibrosis or something like that. They're going to treat that as the use of a new medical biologic, which does have to be approved by the FDA before it can be used in normal medical care. And you have to get what's called an IND to sort of start using it, even to research it. And right now, the FDA has not approved CRISPR for medical care. So if you were to try to do this in the United States right now, the FDA would come down on you very hard, basically saying you are using a biologic that has not yet been approved. That's illegal. You know, if you don't stop, we're going to fine you or put you in jail or whatever the consequences are.
I think we just got time for one more. I think I saw Rick had his hand up. If you want to, you got to unmute. You, Rick, you got to unmute yourself.
Yeah, there. I did. Two quick questions. For the young woman that was getting the sickle cell edited blood cells, when it's found that it works for her, would they be able to use those same blood cells for other people? Or would it be unique to her? And then the other question is, are all vaccines enhancements?
Good questions. On the first one, so we could conceivably use her blood in other people, but it's not clear that that would be the preferable way to do it, because you're going to have to deal with the kind of immune reactions that you might have to deal with when you do bone marrow transplants. So when you do bone marrow transplants, you've got to follow them up with immunosuppressive drugs that carry their own set of risks. Whereas if you're using the patient's own cells that have just been edited with respect to this hemoglobin protein, and you put those same cells back in, you don't have rejection problems. So that's usually going to be the way they want to do it. Okay. I would think that all vaccines count as enhancements. They're given prior to the disease. They're there to make it so that your immune system is better at fighting off a disease, right? It can do it more quickly, so you don't have time for the disease to multiply as long and results in a less severe illness. So I think immunizations and vaccines are sort of common examples of things that are enhancements, but incredibly important.
Thanks.
But there's a lot of philosophy discussion about how exactly to define that treatment enhancement distinction. Some people would say it's not really treatment versus enhancement. It's treatment and prevention versus enhancement. And they would say that immunizations and vaccines count as ways to prevent. But they're not enhancements according to that definition. It's a large, large literature.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Robert. I think we've got to move ahead here. I think Robert, I don't know if you're going to stick around for the discussion, but
I am.
Or stick around for the virtual coffee hour. Maybe we could get some more questions in there. Yep. If people want to do that. So I want to move ahead. I think I'm going to skip the closing song and just go with the closing words, and then we'll move to the virtual coffee hour. So the closing words today are Walk Softly by Elaine Gallagher-Gehrman and read by Nancy.
Walk softly, speak truthfully, love gently, breathe deeply, live wisely, go in peace.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming this week.